I'd love to help you, Detective. Really, I would. But I can't be handing out a private citizen's telephone number to just anybody. How about to an officer of the law? Can you hand it out to him? He shrugs. With proper motivation, I can. In other words, another 50. You really want to go down this route? Because I can arrest you for soliciting a bribe, or I can go get a warrant not for just one transaction, but for all of them. Which one would you prefer? His smug expression disappears. I'll be right back with those numbers. That's what I thought. I drum my fingers on the counter and fume while at the end of an aisle, a teenager slips a pair of Bluetooth earphones into his pocket. As shoplifters go, he's not very good. Too obvious and way too oblivious that a cop is standing 20 feet away at the counter. But he's fast, I'll give him that. In and out the door in 30 seconds flat. My phone buzzes against my hip, and I'm checking the screen when the manager returns from the back office. It's Ma, and I push her to voicemail. With a grunt, the manager shoves two sheets of paper my way, still warm from the copy machine. I smile at what I find there. Four receipts, each with a cell phone number. By now, she'll have burned through two, maybe three of them, but if I'm lucky, one of them will still be trackable. I only need one to lead me to her. I spread the papers on the counter and take a picture of each. I'm attaching them to an email when my mother calls again. She's not going to like it when I push her to voicemail for a second time, but I'll call her back as soon as I send the images to Jade to start tracking. I hit send, then gather up the papers, carry them to my car, and pull up my mother's number on the screen. She picks up on the first ring, and she's pissed. Marcus, what the hell is going on here? I stifle a sigh. Tough to feel self-righteous when you're getting scolded by your mother. What's going on is I'm in the middle of a missing person case. I'm a little busy. I fall into the car, where it's easily 100 degrees, even though I parked in the shade. I crank the engine and aim the vents at my face. I realize that, she says, but I lose her when the call flips to the hands-free system, a 2 or 3 second spot of dead silence. Ma, you still there?
What? I'm here. I've been here all along.
What were you saying? She sighs, an annoyed sound.
I was talking about your house.
What about it?
Why does it look like a hobo lives here?
My skin ices over despite the heat. She's at the house. I shove the gear in reverse and punch the gas, lurching backward into the lot. Where are you, exactly?
I just told you. I'm at your house.
Where at the house? Where are your feet right now? I work the gear shift into drive. Be specific.
Specifically, my feet are parked on your living room carpet, though I can barely see the thing for all the papers. When's the last time you picked up?
I floor the gas, and whatever my mother says next gets lost in the squeal of my tires peeling across the pavement. At the end of the lot, I take a hard right, pulling into traffic to a chorus of beeps and tire screeches. Just in case, I lay on the horn. Her voice crackles over the squad car speakers.
And Marcus, where's Emma?
Mistake number one, giving my mother a house key. Though, for the record, that was all Emma's doing. But what was I going to do when I found out? Ask for the key back? Ma would have had a fit, and I would have had to hear it every holiday and birthday for the rest of my life. I let her keep the key, but if I had any sense at all, I would have changed the locks. Mistake number two, leaving the house in such a state. Though, again, it couldn't be helped. Police work is messy at times, and I'm a visual kind of guy. I like to spread my files across tables and floors, tape notes and pictures to the walls. I picture my mother walking through the kitchen and living room, piecing everything together and shaking her head, and I lean on my horn.
Move it!
I scream at the driver in front of me, flashing my lights, and he flips me off over his shoulder. I swerve onto the shoulder, slam the gas, and fly past. 13 eternal minutes later, I screech into my driveway, coming to a hard stop behind my mother's white Honda. The front door pops open, and she comes out slinging. Her arms, her words, that expression she always used on me when I was a kid, the one that still, to this day, can give me phantom pains of an almost constant childhood bellyache. Even now, all these years later, trying to please this woman is a full-time job. She's fussing at me before I've even clambered out.
Looks like somebody tossed the place. Now, I know you've been busy, but I didn't raise my son to live in a pigsty. Did a tornado blow through town and no one thought to tell me?
I jog up the walkway, boots tearing up the concrete. Ma, what are you doing here? She gives me an insulted frown.
What do you mean, what am I doing here? I made another batch of chicken soup for Emma. That's what people do when one of their loved ones is sick. They bring them chicken soup.
That key was for emergencies only. She points a finger over her shoulder.
Have you seen your house? This is an emergency, and I'll have you know I rang the bell for at least 15 minutes.
Just ask that nosy Ms. Delaney next door.
I went around the side and saw Emma's car in the garage. I thought something happened to her. I thought maybe she'd fainted or fell down the stairs.
She pauses to take me in, shaking her head.
You look awful. When's the last time you've eaten?
For Ma, every bad or busy day, every sickness or heartache or worry, it all boils down to food. What kind, and when you'd last had some, and if it was prepared with loving care and the correct amount of salt. I don't dare tell her the truth, that for the past 3 days I've been living off the leftovers from Annabelle's birthday dinner, standing over the counter, shoveling cold bites straight from the container, barely tasting any of it. But only when I remember to eat, which isn't often. Then again, if she's looked in my kitchen, which she most definitely has, she already knows. The dirty Tupperware is piled high, smelling up the sink. I just came from Leon's, I lie, knowing the restaurant name will make her back off from this portion of the argument at least. Leon's is known for their fried catfish, fried shrimp, fried everything, the kind of fare that'll keep you full for days. Look, I appreciate you coming all the way over here, but Marcus, Robert, Durand, you tell me what's going on right this second. She stabs a fist into her hip and scowls. Where is Emma? I thought she was sick. Why isn't she here? Mistake number 3. I should have had a story ready, a believable excuse I could pull from my sleeve without stumbling over my words. Both of us know Emma would have called to thank Ma for the chicken soup. She would have texted or sent a note. My mother coming over here now isn't about seeing to the health of her favorite daughter-in-law or bringing her some more soup. It's about snagging the thank you she should have gotten days ago. I sigh, nudging my mother inside. She didn't want you to know, okay? She didn't want anyone to know. I shut the door, leaning against the cool wood. Ma's right. This place is a pigsty, and it smells like a barnyard. If I tell you where she is, you can't tell a soul. Not Camille, not Duke, not anybody. Ma's already nodding, quick and manic like a bobblehead. Of course, of course. My lips are sealed. You have my word. I look my mother in the eye and somehow manage to hold her gaze. She's at a retreat. She frowns. What kind of retreat? The kind that makes her better, less depressed. My mother squints, folding her arms across her chest, closing herself off. She always knew when I was lying as a kid, and she knows it now. I kick things up a notch. The thing is, it's just, Em cries all the time, Ma. She, you know what? I don't want to get into the ugly details. What? Why are you looking at me like that? Because this story makes no sense. If your wife is depressed, the last thing you do is send her away. You definitely don't send her off with a bunch of strangers. You keep her here, under your own roof, and you fix things. Above all else, you hold your family together. For my mother, there's no other option. Family is why her kids haven't moved more than 5 miles away, why she summons us to her house every Sunday and on birthdays and holidays, why we haul our asses over there without complaint. Camille and Duke might not remember how Ma practically killed herself, providing for 3 kids on a minimum wage, single mother salary, but I do. I remember her constant exhaustion, the way her worries about money, about what people were saying about our jailbird father, about how the gossip would affect me and Camille and Duke, filled my stomach with something sour and itchy. I remember the sound of her tears when she thought I wasn't listening, how they boiled inside me into a white-hot rage. When Dad died in prison, she lined us up along the gravesite and ordered me to look sad, even though I detested the man. even though I'm pretty sure by then she'd detested him herself. "He's your father," Ma said, smacking me on the back of the head. "Family." "I am holding us together," I tell her now, "or at least I'm trying to, but I can't do that when I'm standing here arguing with you." "Does this retreat?" She uses air quotes and pursed lips to let me know what she thinks of the word. "Have anything to do with what happened at Easter?" I wince, wishing to all hell that she hadn't brought it up. I don't know how else to explain that it was nothing, the product of too many of us crammed into her tiny kitchen. I tossed Emma a pack of napkins, but all she saw was something coming at her head. She let out a scream so blood-curdling it froze everybody's shoes to the linoleum. We all tried really hard to laugh it off, especially Emma, but I saw the way Ma looked at us after that, like she was worried, like she's looking at me now. "Ma, I told you, that was nothing. Em just thought she saw something that wasn't there, that's all." She watches me carefully, her expression hard.
"And what were all those papers on the kitchen table?"
"Work. I'm in the middle of a missing person investigation, remember? I've been working 24/7.
"What do hundreds of Emma's emails have to do with the search for Sabine Hardison?"
Her question tightens around my chest, pushing into my lungs and expanding, sucking up all the air. "I need to get Ma out of here. I need her to leave. The last thing I need is for my mother to be butting into my case." "Maybe nothing, but maybe everything. Sabine showed us a house last year, and she sent Emma a list of people to work with. Inspectors, lenders, things like that. I need to find that list, and I need to talk to those people. They might know something about Sabine."
"Why don't you ask Emma where the list is?"
"Because I'm not allowed to talk to her. The doctors won't let me. Not until she's done with the whole program."
"And when will that be?"
"I don't know yet." Ma doesn't say anything for a really long time. She looks at me, and I look at her, and the longer this stare-down drags on, the more my skin turns cold and clammy. Emma has a good life. She lives in a nice house, drives a nice car, goes to nice restaurants and parties, all things I provide for her. It's more than my deadbeat father ever did for Ma and us kids, and yet there's a hurricane whipping up in my gut at the look on Ma's face. I turned 36 last month, and my mother can still do this to me. "I'll take care of it, Ma. I swear to God, I'm taking care of it." She presses her palms to either side of my face and shakes her head.
"You go. Clean up this mess you made. I'll clean up the one here."
Beth. Hey. I jump at the man's voice and the papers slip from the stack between my fingers, hitting the table and scattering. First Martina, now Irwin Four. It's like visiting hour in here, a revolving door of people coming and going. He stands in the same spot his father did less than an hour ago, looking like he just came from the mall, or maybe a visit with his tailor. The creases in his shirt are knife sharp, his belt buckle so shiny I can see my own reflection. "You scared me." "I noticed." He comes into the room uninvited, dipping his chin at the piles on the table. "New member bags, huh? Looks like fun." I gather up the papers I dropped, shuffle them into a neat pile. "Are you looking for your father? Because he went to visit a sick parishioner." "Mrs. McPherson, I know. Charlene told me." He wanders over, looking over the stacks of papers and brochures on the table. He picks up one of the Bible booklets, flips through it with a thumb. "I hear somebody got into her drawers. Probably the most action she's seen in decades." He gives me a sly grin. "How much did they get away with?" $2,000 is the number I heard. He whistles between his teeth. "That's a pile of cash. Who do you think took it?" I push to a stand, digging through the box for a handful of tote bags and draping the straps over an arm. I'm trying not to think about it too much, to be honest. It's a lie, of course. Like everybody else in this place, I've thought of little else. He tosses the pamphlet back on the stack with a shrug. I just figured since you're up here all day, you might see things others don't. Like somebody sniffing around Charlene's drawers. Ha ha, snicker snicker. As much as I like and respect the Reverend, I'm not getting the same upstanding vibe from his son. I didn't see anybody sniffing around anywhere, I say, as casually as I can. But I also wasn't looking. I've been too busy working. He nods like he doesn't quite buy it. What do you think about my father giving the thief time to return it? I mean, this isn't preschool, and $2,000 is not nothing. If it were me they stole from, I'd have called the cops hours ago. I shrug. I don't know. I'd like to think I'd be as compassionate and forgiving as your father. But there are few people on this planet as soft-hearted as he is. Erwin snorts, sinking into a chair and stretching out his legs. Is that what you kids are calling it these days? Soft-hearted? What, you don't think so? As soon as I pose the question, I wish I hadn't. I don't much care what Erwin IV thinks about his father, or the money, or anything else for that matter. I just want him to leave. The skin on the back of my neck is tingling, the hairs rising up one by one. Home by 10. Straight A's or else. Don't just read, but memorize the Bible, so you're able to chastise sinners with apt verses at all times. Thus is the life of a preacher's son. He sighs, watching me fill the bags on my arm, but not lifting a finger to help. I never see him, not unless I come here. I can't tell you the last time we've had a family dinner. If Erwin IV wants me to feel sorry for him, he's going to have to give me something better than some daddy issues. So his father didn't spend enough time tossing baseballs with him in the front yard. My husband beat me. I want to scream in his face. He put a gun in my mouth and pressed his finger to the trigger, and he's looking for me right now so he can finish the job. I think all these things, but I press my lips together and move down the table, dropping coffee mugs in the bags, when what I'd really like to do is bean Erwin IV in the head with one. Hey, I have a question for you, he says, almost conversationally. What did you do to get Oscar's job? My hands freeze mid-reach, and my head whips in his direction. Excuse me? Like, do you stroke my dad's ego? Tell him how kind and wise he is. Convince him to do you favors. Oddly enough, that's a confirmed technique to make a person like you, you know. The person who does the favor actually ends up liking the other person more. Weird, I know, but true. He laughs in a way that is the opposite of funny. Or maybe you're the one doing him favors. It's not just his words, but the way he's looking at me. Like I'm some sort of puzzle to be put together. Like I'm slightly dirty. A phone rings out in the hallway, but distant, at the far end. Martina's warning floats through my mind. Erwin IV is a creep. Stay far, far away. I hope you're not implying what I think you are. I'm not implying anything. I'm trying to figure you out. What my dad sees that the rest of us can't. And while we're at it, if you have any tips on how to win some affection for me and my sister, I'm all ears. How about stop acting like a spoiled brat? Maybe don't be an asshole? I get that the pressure on a preacher's kid must be enormous, but Erwin IV should be able to see the bigger picture, that he has a father who cares enough to hold him to a higher moral standard than others in his flock. That should count for something. You and your sister are hardly unloved, I say. Your father talks about you all the time. You're even his computer password. The Reverend asked me not to mention it, but I'm pretty sure if he heard this conversation, he'd say something similar. Erwin Grace, too, I know. What, you don't think IT has access to the computer passwords around here? I don't answer. If Erwin IV runs the IT, if he knows how to log on to his father's computer, He'll know how to pluck Sabine's story from the history files. I study him for clues. But then again, maybe him cornering me here is the biggest clue of all. The first pinpricks of understanding burn like hot ice on my skin. He raises both hands, lets them fall back to his lap. Do you believe what my dad preaches? That marriage is a holy covenant between three people, a man, a woman, and God. I almost laugh. Almost. Not just because this conversation is ridiculous, but also because if God had been anywhere near my marriage, he wouldn't have just stood by and watched you slap and punch and kick me. He would have shielded me. He would have taken one for the team. Another thing I've never really given much thought, I say carefully. Well, I have. And let me tell you, it's yet another reason for me to never tie the knot. That is a threesome I am not the least bit interested in. He stands. And at that moment, right there and then, is when I feel it. Something stark and obvious. Something not right. I put some space between us, scooping items from the table into the bags, hurrying farther down the line. What about sin? What are your feelings on that? Why are you asking me? I'm hardly an expert on anything biblical. Because you're not one of Dad's mindless sheep. You're not going to parrot his words back at me. I get enough of that at home. I'd like to hear an honest answer from someone like me. Someone who's bitten into more than a few apples. His gaze wanders south. Alarm zips up my spine. I turn away, tugging on my t-shirt. I've made mistakes, hasn't everybody? Yes, but according to my dad, sin is preordained. The Bible tells us not to sin at the same time it tells us we're destined to lie and cheat and steal. If you ask me, that's the whole problem with Christianity. It takes away an individual's free will. It renders us powerless. Leave, a voice screams in my head. Don't stay here alone with this man. I eye the distance between Irwin Four and the door, the way he's standing there like a roadblock. I don't think it's about taking power away, I say slowly, buying myself some time. I drop the bags in the box and edge around to the opposite side of the table. But to give it back. Choose God and go to heaven. Isn't that the point? You didn't answer my question. He steps to the right, and I ease to the left. I'm pretty sure I did. Get out, get out, get out. In three lightning steps, Irwin Four is in front of me, smelling of aftershave and astringent and beer? Or maybe that's my memory playing tricks on me. No, I'm pretty sure you didn't. The question still stands. How do you feel about original sin? Good.
He runs a finger down my forearm, his touch so light I have to actually look down to make sure it was real.
Or bad.
I don't move because I can't. A wave of disgust, so intense I'm paralyzed, sticks my sneakers to the floor. The air between us shimmers, and I'm transported to another time, another place. A dusty field at last year's annual barbecue. I remember everything about that day. How the afternoon air was muggy and hot. The official start of what would be a sweltering summer. How the beer was flowing faster than the river behind the bandstand, and how you chugged it from a red solo cup. How when I made a joke saying you might want to switch to water, you laughed and ran your finger down my forearm, soft and light as a feather, like Irwin Ford did just now. But only because people were watching. Your laugh was for them, but the words you whispered in my ear were for me. You leaned in, stinking of beer and fury. If you ever, and I mean ever, embarrass me like that again, I will kill you and dump your body somewhere no one will ever find it.
It's your face I see now, when Erwin Four leans in, your breath heating up my cheek.
I think you took the money, Beth,
he says, low and deadly.
And if you're nice, I might just let you keep it.
There's only one thing to do here, really. Only one way to satisfy both my temper and my terror. I look Erwin Four in the face and knee him hard in the balls, and then I'm off at a dead run.
Marcus. Ma starts upstairs while I gather up the files I'd spread across the living room and kitchen, unpin the papers from the wall, and toss everything in a basket I fetch from the laundry room. I can't stay in the house, not with Ma's weighted sighs and worried stares. I haul the basket to the car, dump it in the trunk, and drive to the station. The place is changing shifts by the time I arrive, beat-weary cops trudging out the door, nodding to their fresh-faced replacements like an unspoken passing of batons. I don't want to think too hard about how long I've been on the job, or how little I slept last night. I'm running on fumes and adrenaline, like I do every time I'm nearing a break on a case. Something big is about to happen. I can feel it. The papers with the four phone numbers are burning a hole in my pocket, excitement vibrating in the deepest part of my bones. I park at the edge of the lot and head to the door. "Hey, Marcus," another detective says, nodding at the basket in my arms. "Rick's gym clothes are stinking up the office if you're doing a load." "Har, get the door for me, will you?" He backtracks a couple steps, pulls on the handle. "Oh, and Chief was looking for you earlier. Watch your six, he's on the warpath." "Great." A grilling from Chief Eubanks is the very last thing on my agenda. He's the kind of cop who was born to wear a uniform, an eternally grumpy guy who barks out orders in a tone that makes grown men shake in their buffed boots. I take the long way to my desk, sneaking up the back staircase and looping around. I don't relax until I step into my office, where the chief is sitting in my chair, looking through a pile of papers I really wish he wasn't reading. "Oh, hey, chief." He doesn't look up. I settle the laundry basket on the floor, kick it so it's half hidden under the desk. "Can I help you find something?" He stabs a finger to the top page. "Yeah, you can tell me what this means. Charlotte, Louisville, Jacksonville, Raleigh, Atlanta." He looks up over his half-moon reading glasses. "You have some reason to believe Sabine Hardison is on the run?" It's the assumption Jade made as well. I sink into the chair across from the chief, the one I normally offered to guests, and swing my ankle over a knee, relaxed and casual. "Just covering all the bases, sir. The husband said it wouldn't have been the first time. She has a history of antidepressants and wasn't exactly stable." Chief peels off the glasses and tosses them on the desk. "Yeah, well, funny you should mention the husband. I received a call from Olivia Spinella. I'm sure you know who that is." I shake my head, the name squirming in my belly. I don't know who Olivia Spinella is, but the fact Chief's bringing her up can't be good. "Not familiar, no." "Ms. Spinella is Jeffrey Hardison's attorney. She claims Jeffrey has an alibi for the window of time his wife went missing, and she also claims you knew about it when you showed up at her client's house 2 days ago to harass him." I wasn't harassing him. I was questioning him. There's something fishy about his alibi. Why not be straight about where he was? Why not just say what he was doing in Little Rock? "At 2:30 p.m., Mr. Hardison checked in at the offices of a Dr. Lee, a urologist at CHI St. Vincent in Little Rock. His appointment took about 40 minutes, after which he got his prescription filled at the hospital pharmacy downstairs. The prescription was for Viagra, and his attorney has offered up the still full bottle as evidence. It seems Mr. Hardison had plans to reinvigorate his marital relationship with Mrs. Hardison that night, but he never got the chance." His words are like a punch to the gut, and I try my damnedest not to wince. Oh. Yeah. Oh. He heaves a heavy sigh, never a good sign. Ms. Spinella and Mr. Hardison would like to know what we're doing to find his wife, and to tell you the truth, I'd like to hear the answer, too. Where are you looking? What leads are you exploring? Chief Eubanks knows better than anybody here the limitations I'm working under. There are 16 detectives under this leaky roof, and we've shared 357 case files so far this year. All of us have more work than we can handle, and the city won't grant us pay raises or overtime. We're the most necessary workforce in a city that doesn't appreciate us. It's no wonder that every year our rank shrinks. And yet, it sure feels like the chief here is accusing me of not doing the legwork. Come on, chief. You know I work harder than anybody in this place. Everything I've done has been by the book. I interviewed her friends and family. I combed her computer and tracked her phone. I looked at her bank accounts, even found a couple her husband didn't know about. He gives me a slow nod, and a pounding starts up in the base of my skull. I also received a complaint from Trevor McAdams, he says. I take a deep breath, blow it out long and slow. Is that so? He claims you came to his house with all sorts of accusations about Sabine, that she's unstable, that she faked a pregnancy test. You want to explain yourself? She was unstable. The pharmacy confirmed an ongoing prescription for antidepressants and that she had an adverse reaction when she went off them cold turkey last year. She has a history of difficulty getting pregnant as well as a long string of miscarriages. I haven't been able to confirm she was actually pregnant or if she had some sort of irregularity that made it impossible to stay that way. So you think what? That she had some kind of a breakdown and took off? I lift both hands like, maybe. Like I said, sir, I'm just covering all the bases. And Shelley McAdams skipped town the day her husband's lover disappeared. There's definitely motive there, maybe opportunity as well. The doctor wants you to stay away from her, too. I puff a laugh. I'll bet he does. Did you question her? She's in Chicago through the weekend. Do you have enough to haul her back? I'm working on it. In other words, no. Chief shakes his head. This McAdams guy is a doctor, Marcus. He's smart, respected. Determined as hell. He's not some guy off the street. I bite down on a scowl, clear my expression. I'm aware of that, sir. He knows his rights, and he's not playing around. He's got a shitload of folks on Twitter who think you're incompetent, or at the very least, dragging your feet. I don't know if you've seen his feed, but they're killing you over there. Oh, I've seen his feed, all right. It's just as infuriating as the guy is in real life, a constantly rolling wall of melodramatic wails into the void. One second he's pissed, then next he's blubbering like a baby. His emotions bounce around like a dented ping-pong ball with no clue where it's going to land next. The tweets have a constant theme, though, and that's me. I'm obstinate, thick-headed, on the wrong path. Last time I scrolled through it, I punched my fist through a wall. He wants you off the case. He's threatening to sue, and he's got the money and the pull to make good on his threats. Is that what this is about? You want me off the case? There's a long beat of silence, too long. And I try not to squirm like a two-bit criminal brought in for questioning, even though that's exactly how I feel. That's my chair he's sitting in, my desk he's plunked his Popeye forearms on, my case he's grilling me on. I can't have him take it away. My desk phone lights up, the ring shrill in the silent room, and a burst of electricity surges under my skin. Jade, calling me from downstairs. Chief Eubanks ignores the phone. If you want to pass this case to another detective, I don't. If you've got other things you need to deal with or need some cooling down time, I don't. I say through gritted teeth because one time, just once, I lose my shit with some asshole pointing a cell phone camera at my head and the chief is still bringing it up 2 years later. The phone rings for a third time and he reaches for his glasses, folding them up and slipping them into a pocket on his shirt. I want a report. I want to know what leads you are following, what people you are talking to, what you are doing with my hard-earned tax dollars to find Sabine Hardison, and I want it on my desk by the end of the day. The chief leaves, and I sit here, breathing through my rage. Fucking Jeffrey Hardison and his fucking attorney. Fucking Dr. McAsshole. The footsteps fade into silence in the hall, and I punch in the number for Jade. Please, tell me you have good news.
That depends. Atlanta's kind of a hike, and I hear it's really hot this time of year.
She snorts, but I'm in no mood for joking around. I shove the door closed with a foot and edge around my desk, holding the cord high so it doesn't snag. Tell me.
Okay, so I found a cluster of check-ins and from a whole slew of IP addresses. They're kind of all over the place, which means they're most likely coming from a cell phone.
Any of the burner numbers?
I can't see the cell phone numbers, only the IP of the carrier. And a carrier's IP address changes all the time depending on the cell phone tower it's pinging. The only exception is when the cell hops onto a Wi-Fi network and then it becomes static.
My head is pounding. I yank open my top drawer, reach in for the bottle of Excedrin, industrial-sized, because of all the moments like this one. I don't give a shit about IPs and cell phone towers, only where they point. So did you find her or not?
Hold your horses, Sparky. I'm getting there. I've got two addresses for you, each of them with dozens of hits, both of them coming from inside Atlanta city limits. One for a boarding house on English Street and the other for a church.
She rattles off the addresses and I scribble them onto the pad. And the burner numbers? The manager gave me four, all of which I passed on to Jade less than an hour ago.
Those are up next. I'll call you as soon as I've got something. Now go out there and get her.
I'm already on my feet, already thinking about the fastest route to the airport. On my way.
Beth. I am packed and banging on Miss Sally's door in record time. By my calculations, a mere 27 minutes after kneeing Irwin IV in the balls. The whole time I was hurtling through rush hour traffic to Morgan House and stuffing my belongings into a bag, I was doing the math. 4 minutes, maybe five for the little shit to pull himself off the floor. Double that for him to sound the alarm. He'll spew lies and false accusations, which means I need to hurry. I lift my fist and bang on the door again. "Hang on, hang on, I'm coming," Miss Sally's voice says through the wood. She pulls the door open with a smile. "Hey, sugar, what are you..." Uh-oh. "Why are you so sweaty?" I don't really wait for her to invite me in. I wriggle my way past. "And how come you're panting? Did you run all the way here?" She shuts the door behind me, flipping the lock with a metallic clunk, and the noise sends a sliver of panic up my chest. My gaze flicks to the windows, two paned sheets of glass, plenty big enough for an escape. And then I see the rest of the room and I freeze. "What's wrong?" she says, taking in my expression. "What happened?" I don't answer because I can't. I am rigid with shock, my entire body frozen at the spectacle that is Miss Sally's room. It looks like something out of a movie set, dark and blood red, with sculpted molding and carved furniture, Victorian behemoths with stubby clawed feet. There's velvet everywhere. Rich maroon and burgundy, lined in fringe and hung with tassels. Even the walls are papered in it, lit up with an occasional filigreed brass lamp. And on every horizontal surface, on the tables and cabinets and elaborately carved stands, are sculptures of very large, very erect penises. It's like Moulin Rouge meets gay porn, an orgy of Belle Époque with homosexual brothel. I turn in a slow circle, taking it all in. "What is this place? Where am I?" "You like it, huh?" Miss Sally sinks onto an overstuffed love seat, patting the cushion beside her. "Now come on, you sit down and tell Miss Sally what happened. What's got you all in a tizzy?" I tear my gaze off a ruby dildo lamp, telling her the 2-second version. "I need the pastor's son in the balls, and now I have to leave." Disappointment flashes across her face. "Wait a minute. You don't just knee some poor sucker in the balls, not without a reason. There's got to be more to the story than that. Miss Sally wants to know what it is.
As much as I'd love to tell you everything, I don't have time. I use this address on my job application.
So, you're leaving. Miss Sally is a lot of things, but stupid is not one of them.
I nod, acknowledging an unexpected pang. I didn't realize until now how much I'll miss Morgan House, how much I've come to think of it as home, even if only a temporary one. I sink onto the couch next to her, brushing away the sadness. The police will be here any minute. It's past time to go.
How much do I owe you?
Well, it's past noon, she says, crossing her long legs. Under her white eyelet skirt, they're lotioned into a high shine, reflecting in the room's dim light like glass.
I'll have to charge you through tomorrow.
That's fine. How much? I expect her to check a list, to pull up some file on her computer, or at the very least reach for a calculator. But she rattles off a number without the slightest hesitation, like Rain Man.
$120.
I peel off the bills and hand them to her. Can I borrow a piece of paper and a pen? She stands, fetching some from a sideboard on the opposite wall. Perfume stationery and a fountain pen, of course. I kneel, scribbling my message on a glass-topped side table. When I'm done, I fold it twice, write Martina's name on the outside, and hand it to Miss Sally.
Do you know where you're going?
She says, pocketing the note. I will when I get there. Miss Sally gives me a sad smile.
You take care of yourself, you hear?
You bet. And thanks for everything. I'm really going to miss this place. She grabs me by a shoulder and yanks me in for a hug. I wasn't expecting it, and for the first few seconds stands stiff as a board in her arms. But she smells so good, and her breasts are like two giant soft pillows against my cheek, so I relax and give in to the embrace, even though the clock is ticking. She pats me on the back with a giant paw, murmurs into my hair.
Poor sweet girl. It gets easier, you know.
What does? She cranes back her head to look down, arching her back, and something unexpected presses into my leg.
Running, starting over. But you're smart and you're stronger than you know. You'll find your place.
It's all I can do to nod. She releases me, waving a rose-scented hand through the air.
Now get out of here. I got shit to do.
A few seconds later, I'm racing down the back streets to where I parked my car, a couple blocks away, thinking that's one mystery solved at least. Miss Sally's boobs might be bigger than mine, but she definitely wasn't born female. Dear Martina, sorry I ditched you today, and sorrier still that I lied. As usual, you were right. I'm the one who took the money from Charlene's desk. I know, stealing from a church is pretty much a one-way ticket to hell. But I had my reasons. Valid ones, I promise. Tell the Reverend it was me, will you? Make him point the police away from you and the cleaning crew. And tell everybody, too, that I'm really, truly sorry. Thanks for everything. For Jorge, for the job, for your friendship. Especially the last one. One day, when all of this is behind me, I hope I can come back to thank you in person. Be safe. XO. Beth. When it comes to finding a new place to stay, the $2,000 from Charlene's top desk drawer and the Georgia ID in my pocket have certainly broadened my search parameters. I don't dare to turn on my phone, which I powered down as I was running out the church door, so I drive to a new part of town and putter up and down random streets until I spot a motel advertising rooms for the bargain basement price of $22 a night. It's an ancient three-story building, wedged into the downtown connector, one wing literally hanging over the overpass, which probably explains the price. One semi too many rumbling by its shabby walls, and they'll come crumbling down.
The lot is packed, but I find a vacant spot between two rusted-out heaps that make the Regal look like a late-model Cadillac. Two men lean against the railing on an upper-floor catwalk, watching me make the trek to the office. I acknowledge them, but I don't wave or smile. The office is tiny, a windowless room with a couple of ratty chairs and a desk behind bulletproof plexiglass. The woman sitting behind it is nondescript, drab hair dragged into a low ponytail, an unlined and makeup-free face, a lumpy body under shapeless clothes. A boring slice of white bread compared to the smorgasbord of color that is Miss Sally. She waves off my ID.
You don't need that here. You alone?
I nod.
Then you'll want a room upstairs. Fewer stray bullets up there.
An upstairs room would mean a more difficult escape route should the need arise. And it will. Without my cell to guide them to me, Irwin Four and the police might not find me here. But you will. I can maybe fight you off, if I'm prepared, if I take you by surprise. But I can't fight off a bullet. I take the upstairs room. Do you happen to know if there's a Best Buy nearby? She rattles off directions to one a couple of miles away, then slides the key card under the screen along with the Wi-Fi code. I thank her and head back to the car. After a few wrong turns, the Regal and I make it to the Best Buy, where I select a mid-priced laptop, another piece of crap smartphone with a stockpile of prepaid minutes, and a pretty pink phone case with butterflies swimming in golden glitter on the back. Just because. The grand total comes to $846.23.
Whoa,
the sales clerk says when I start peeling bills off a wad of cash.
This is Atlanta, girl. Put that away.
I speed up the counting, even though I know it makes me look suspicious, or at the very least, memorable. I also know there are two little cameras mounted to the ceiling on either side of my head, capturing my face in full color, high definition, and that those are only the two that I've seen. How many others did I miss on my jaunt around the store? Dozens, I'm betting. I push the thick mound of cash across the counter. The clerk counts it, then counts it again. It takes him longer than it should. I'm paying in mostly fives and ones, crumpled and wrinkly from the church collection basket. To be clear, I wouldn't have taken the money if I didn't need it. And I won't be keeping it, not even a penny. Every single cent will make its way back into the Reverend's collection basket at some point, even if it takes me years to repay it. I close my eyes, press a palm to what's left in my money belt, and remind myself that this is who I am now. Beth Louise Murphy. A runner. A thief. The clerk passes me my change and a plastic bag bulging with electronics I could have never otherwise afforded. I'm back in the Buick a few seconds later, steering the car down the street to my next stop, a CVS I passed on the way. I pluck a basket from the stack by the door and stroll the aisles, dropping in items from my mental list. Black liquid eyeliner. Burgundy lipstick. Enough groceries to tide me over for a day or two. Toothpaste. A box of Miss Clairol. I pay cash and console myself with the only bright spot I can find in this shitty, shameful day. I've always wanted to be a redhead. I'm pulling into traffic when the skies open up, the rain forming a shimmering silver curtain on the other side of my windshield. I flip the wipers as high as they'll go, but they can't clear the glass fast enough. I squint into traffic and think maybe the flash flood is a sign. An omen of things to come. You are coming for me. And I will be ready.
Marcus. By the time I pick up my rental car at the Atlanta airport and point it north to the city, it's almost 10, and the highway is dark and slick with rain. It floods the streets and beats on the roof and windows, jamming the lanes with the remnants of one hell of a rush hour. The road in front of me is basically a parking lot of taillights, flashing bright red. I hit the hazard lights, nudge my way onto the shoulder, and punch through the gridlock. The GPS spits me out at 1071 English Street. One of the addresses, Jade said, had a cluster of IP check-ins to the department website and Facebook page. I ease to the curb and squint through the rain, clocking the fresh coat of paint, the picket fencing, the light spilling from windows lined with frilly curtains. This place is too nice to be a boarding house. Way too nice. How the hell does she afford it? I jog through the rain to the door. On the covered porch, I lean my face into one of the windows and peer into a living room. Three men are lined up on a navy couch, beer bottles resting on their bellies, faces tipped to a Braves game on a flat screen. I study their profiles, their clothing, the size of their feet propped up on the coffee table. The middle one, long and lean and still in possession of most of his hair. He looks like the type to hit on another man's wife. Is he staring at the TV and thinking about her? Is she in one of the rooms upstairs thinking about him? Thunder rumbles overhead, and I rub a fist over my breastbone instead of what I really want to do, punch it through the glass. I take deep breaths until I get myself under control, then ring the doorbell with a thumb. It's not one of the men, but a woman, tall and curvy in a hot pink robe and hair curlers, who opens the door. She flips on the porch light, and whoa! I stumble backward on the porch planks and look again. That ain't no woman, nope. No way in hell. He looks down his powdered nose. Can I help you? Okay, so the voice belongs to a man, but those breasts, they look, well, if not real, then definitely expensive. I raise my gaze and, oh shit, he caught me. I gesture over my shoulder at the rain clattering to the asphalt and sheets behind me. Some weather, huh? He doesn't seem the least bit amused. I clear my throat and turn up the charm. I'm new to town. Just got in, actually. I heard this place has really nice rooms. Sorry, we're full. He starts to close the door, but I stop it with a boot. What's your rate? I say, giving him a chummy smile. Because I'll pay double. I already told you, we're full. He looks down at my foot, planted in the open doorway. Now please don't make me tell you to remove your boot from my door. Or else what? You'll call the cops? His glossy lips curl in a smile. Come on, honey, we both know you are a cop. Why don't we just drop the charade? You tell me why you're standing here dripping all over my welcome mat, and I'll tell you if I can help you or not. I'm looking for somebody. He rolls his eyes. You don't say. 5'8", long dark hair, though she may have cut it since this was taken. I pull up a picture on my phone, flip it around so he can see. He leans down to take a closer look at the screen, and I get a partial view of a woman standing behind him, a knockout Latina in khakis and a t-shirt. Her eyes are wide, her expression frozen in surprise, or maybe fear. I lift my chin, and she steps out of sight. Sorry. The man in the pink robe straightens. He shakes his head, and a curler bobs behind a pierced earlobe. I've never seen that woman before. He's lying. I've been a cop long enough to recognize all the signs. The tightening of the skin around his eyes, the way the sarcasm disappears from his tone. He knows. Okay, well, I appreciate your time, I say, stepping back. I flip up my collar, and water runs down the back of my neck. Y'all have a good night. He shuts the door without a word, and I return to my car, sidestepping puddles and grinning like a fool. If she's not here, then I know where to find her. It was written on the pretty girl's face, across her generous chest in big black letters. God works here. My eyes pop open at 5 the next morning, and I'm instantly awake. I flip on the lamp on the nightstand and unhook my phone from the charger, wishing this crappy hotel had room service or a coffee machine because I slept for shit. The chief didn't like my report. He claims it was half-assed, stitched together in a quarter of the time it should have taken me. He told me this in a long, shouty voicemail that ended with him taking me off the case. He's passing the search for Sabine on to Detective Phillips, and if I weren't so pissed, I'd be insulted.
Detective Phillips is a hack, a lazy investigator with questionable tactics and a 50-50 success rate. I need to get my ass back to Pine Bluff like yesterday to make sure Sabine's case lands on the right side. An alert sounds on my phone, and I watch the emails roll in. Junk, mostly, but between the Facebook notifications and ads for penis implants and energy-efficient windows, I spot the one I've been waiting for, from Jade. I tap it with a thumb. 3 of the burners are a bust, but one's still live, the 607 number. No calls yet, but plenty of activity, including loads of check-ins from a hotel on the highway in Atlanta. And jackpot! They have a microcell. When you're ready to go after her, give me a call and I'll help you track her in real time. Jay. I toss the phone on the bed and head for the shower. I'm dressed and behind the wheel of my rental 30 minutes later, a cup of coffee steaming in the holder. The streets are filling with early morning traffic, slowing the drive to the boarding house to a crawl. On English Street, I do a quick reconnaissance loop around the block, then park under a dogwood at the far end of the street. By now, the rain has moved on. The sky is cloudless and bright, giving me a clear view of the front door. I drink my coffee and watch the residents file out. The 3 men from the couch, now in construction gear. Folks in kitchen attire, an apron slung over his shoulder. The pretty Latina in a ponytail and the same t-shirt she wore last night. She makes a beeline to an ancient clunker on the street, looking around as if she's searching for someone. She falls in the car and cranks the engine, and after 3 tries, it catches in a burst of black smoke. I start the rental and follow. The girl winds her way through the neighborhood and onto the interstate while I stay out of sight a couple of cars back. I already know where she's going, have already staked out the route from the boarding house to the church, and she follows it to a T. The only thing I'm a little surprised about, and sure, also a little disappointed to see, is that she's doing it alone. The way she looked at me last night, she knows something. I'm certain of it. She takes a right onto the church driveway, and I go straight, gawking out the side window. The building is massive, a monster of brick and beige stone built to impress. A megachurch to beat all megachurches. It fills my rearview mirror as I hang a U-turn and pull into a parking lot across the street. I find a spot by the road, kill the engine, and reach for my phone. After striking out with the drag queen, I'm trying a different tactic today. I poked around last night on the church's website long enough to find a cover, a church mission trip to build a school in Guatemala this fall, and a call for skilled volunteers. I don't know shit about construction, but I know how to sling a hammer and a nail and some bullshit. As soon as the clock rounds 9, I start the car and peel across 5 lanes of traffic. The blonde, seated behind the receptionist desk, has an accent as sweet as her pink blouse and fat white pearls. A fancy kind of drawl that belongs in a plantation town strung up with Spanish moss. Her name, she tells me, is Charlene. I lean an elbow on her counter, and she blushes under my gaze. Nice to meet you, Charlene. My name's Marcus. I saw on the website you all were looking for some skilled volunteers for a trip you've got planned to Central America. Where was it? Costa Rica? Guatemala. I snap, pointing at her with a finger. That's right, Guatemala. It just so happens that I run a construction company down in Macon with a group of skilled and enthusiastic guys who are looking to give back. I was thinking, you give them the opportunity, I give them a few days off, and we make everybody happy. She clasps her hands on the desk and leans across it. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. The Reverend is definitely going to want to talk to you. Batting eyelashes, lingering gazes, that glimmer of hope when she smiles up at me. This woman wants something from me. She's making it very clear. But I'm not at all interested, not when I'm this close to my target. I point down the long hallway to my right. Is the Reverend in? Oh, she springs up from her chair, comes around the side. It's the other way, but yes, come with me, I'll take you right back. Charlene leads me down a shorter hallway, stopping before a door at the end. Reverend, there's someone here to see you about the Guatemala trip. Send him in, a voice calls out from inside the room. And bring us some coffee, if you would, please.
She turns to me with a flirty smile. Coming right up. The man behind the desk is long and lean, with the sunken cheeks of a marathon runner. He stands, extending a lanky arm. Reverend Irwin Andrews, how are you with a hammer? Marcus Durand of Durand Construction. And I can drive a nail in 3 slams flat. So can all my men, 7 of us, including myself. Do any of y'all speak Spanish? I laugh. I don't know how familiar you are with the construction business in this country, Reverend, but all of us speak Spanish. Excelente, he says, slapping his thighs. What about music? What about it? Do you sing, play any instruments? We could use somebody on bass guitar, banjo would be even better, and we're always looking to add to the choir. This guy's a trip in his pressed polo and salon haircut. Nothing like the solemn Father Ian. I'm guessing the Reverend didn't take a vow of poverty. I shake my head. Nope, sorry, but my wife is pretty decent on the piano, or at least she used to be. Well, bring her along. I'm sure we can get our hands on a keyboard. We spend the next half hour going over the details of the trip, dates and costs, and required immunizations, all of which I tell him won't be a problem. The guy's a talker, and I nod and smile and pretend to listen, when really I'm just waiting for the right moment. It comes as he's walking me out. Oh, I almost forgot, I say, almost as an afterthought. I think I passed somebody I know in the hallway earlier, but she disappeared before I could chase her down. She's the neighbor of a friend of mine who lives in one of those houses on English Street. About yay high, real pretty, Latina. The Reverend brightens. You must be talking about Martina. Yes, she's been with us for 6 months now. She's a lovely, lovely girl. I nod, smiling. That's her. Please tell her I said hi. Oh, and tell that friend of hers, too. I can't remember her name. Do you mean Beth? She and Martina are attached at the hip, or at least they were until just a few days ago. I'm afraid I can't talk about the circumstances. I raise both brows. Try not to let on that my pulse just surged. I hope everything's okay. He makes a face I take as a no. I'm certainly praying it is. Include her in yours tonight, if you don't mind. Consider it done. I shake the Reverend's hand for a second time, rattle off another round of thanks, and promise to email him the list of names and passport numbers in the next few days. Then I hurry to my car, one word, roaring like a train horn through my head. Beth. The bitch is calling herself Beth.
Beth. Room 313 of the Atlanta Motel is as bad as I thought it would be. A dark, damp space that reeks of cigarette smoke and body odor. The bedspread is a throwback to the 80s, a threadbare floral thing covered in stains I don't want to think too much about. Which is why I slept fully clothed and curled up under a scratchy bath towel I spread across the sheets. The air conditioning unit under the window rattled and wheezed all night long. But on a bright note, it drowned out the shouting coming from the room next door. I haul my body off the bed and turn off the air. The room falls into silence, my neighbors on either side still sleeping off whatever they shoved up their veins. I peek out the curtains onto the catwalk. Empty. Beyond it, the sun is blazing, beating down on the parking lot with an almost hostile brightness. People call this place Hotlanta for a reason. In the tiny bathroom, the remnants of last night's makeover are lined up on a narrow glass shelf and in smudged lines on my face. My emo makeup, black-lined eyes and dark-stained lips that no amount of soap could scrub off, and hair a color God could never have intended. The box promised me a rich reddish-brown, but the chemicals on my short, overprocessed locks came out less radiant auburn and more Bozo the Clown. I look ridiculous, but also completely unrecognizable. I brush my teeth and return to the bed, pulling my new computer from the box and firing it up for the first time. The screen shuttles me through the setup, and I pause at the prompts. Name, email address, geographic location. Every one of them feels like a trap. Each answer a potential landmine.
I think of all the people who are looking for me. The Reverend, Irwin Four, Martina, you. And remind myself to be careful. Once the computer is activated, I hop online with the code I got at check-in. Say what you will about this shithole motel, but its Wi-Fi is top-notch. The World Wide Web at my fingertips and at lightning speed. I enter the address for the local Pine Bluff newspaper in the search bar. The screen loads, and there she is. Sabine, the top story. And then I read the letters above her head, and the room and the air turn solid. Missing Pine Bluff woman found dead. A wave of nausea pushes up from the pit of my stomach, catching and swelling in my throat. I hold it back with a hand pressed hard to my lips, but the effort breaks me into a cold sweat. Sabine is not missing. She's not in hiding. She's dead. The knowledge hits me in a cold, horrible, horrifying rush, and I feel weightless, not quite falling, not quite steady on the bed. I see Sabine's face on the Reverend's television screen, and each of those times I went searching for more news, hoping, praying she was safe somewhere, hiding. I double over, hugging myself and fighting a sudden pressure in my chest. Is this what a heart attack feels like? The truth is, I should have expected this. Since I first heard Sabine was missing, I've been frantic for some sort of update. The dread has been building for days, trembling in the hollows of my bones during the day, poking me away at night with a worry that was too big, too terrifying to sleep through. This news has been coming all along. On some level, I've always known. Outside on the catwalk, two men are negotiating a drug deal. They're arguing about price, debating quality of product. But their voices are muffled by the roaring in my ears. All I catch are broken words, fragments of sentences, like the one swimming on my computer screen. Body. Badly decomposed. Autopsy. I spring to my feet and pace in front of the bed. How stupid was I to think this was only about me running from my past, from you. I was prepared to fight for my freedom, to pay for it with blood and broken bones, but I never stopped to consider that I might not be your only victim. I sink onto the bed, my eyes growing hot. Poor, sweet Sabine. I read the rest of the article in chunks, digesting the details with a rising horror. Sabine was strangled, her neck broken in two places, the bones and windpipe crushed. Her body was weighted and dumped into a pond off Highway 133, where it rotted for at least a week, maybe more. Something, a boat, the wildlife, worked her free from her underwater grave, and she bobbed and floated until a hunter and his dog found her face down in the reeds. She'd been picked apart by buzzards. Buzzards. Oh, my God. I picture Sabine's body decaying away at the bottom of some unnamed pond, and the image knocks the breath out of me. For a second or two, I can't move, can't even think, and then my brain kicks into overdrive, flashing the faces of people I've seen splashed across the news, that heartsick doctor, Sabine's twin sister, her husband, people who loved her, who prayed for her and wanted her back. My heart breaks at the idea they're picturing the same thing. I drop my face in my hands and give in to my tears, crying for Sabine, for her friends and family, for me, for my own grief and fury and horror and rage and guilt, most of all for my guilt. Because I know Jeffrey is not the one who wrapped his fingers around her throat. He's not the one who squeezed until two bones snapped. Not the one who left her for the buzzards. I know it was you. Beth. 10 days prior. I crouched behind a juniper hedge, watching balloons bob above the open house sign, and waited until everybody left. A gaggle of blonde brokers in teetering heels, an older couple I recognized from church, a straggler with his pockets full of food. Sabine had once told me there were always moochers. She'd laughed as she said it, as if she couldn't care less that strangers stopped by with the sole motivation of snagging some snacks. And I remember thinking she was so nice, so understanding and generous. And that was even before she offered to help me. But the point is, I waited until everybody was gone. When it was all quiet, I craned my head around the branches, searched up and down the street. No cars, no pedestrians out walking their dog in this heat. Only the sounds of traffic on Hazel Street humming in the distance. Still, I waited, and I watched, and I listened. 7 years with you had taught me I could never be too careful. When I was certain it was safe, I burst out of the shrubs to the side door. Sabine was stacking leftover cookies into a plastic container when I came into the kitchen. She saw me and she sucked in a breath. What are you doing here? Is everything okay? Oh my God, don't move, and get away from that window. She shooed me out of sight and rushed past, her heels clicking on the marble. I heard the metallic clunk of the front door lock sliding into place, and 2 seconds later she was back. She looked me over for cuts and bruises. Are you okay? Are you hurt? Only my ribs, I say, cradling my right side with a palm. But nothing's broken. Anyone else would have asked how I knew, but not Sabine. Sabine knew what you did to me. All those times you threw me down the stairs. The punches and the kicks and the bites. The concussions and broken ribs. She knew what you were capable of. And she helped me anyway. Do you even remember meeting her? I bet you don't, do you? Sabine was the broker on that house on Hillcroft Street, the one we looked at last year. It was more a house than we could afford, but